Wait just a second. Okay.
What shall we talk about? Shall I just continue or shall I talk about life in Poland?
No, why don't you finish this first?
Okay,
you're finished.
Let me then tell you about my marriage, and I really ought to go back. Okay. I married a woman. I married. Her name is Jean Doris Berg.
D-O-R-I-S-B-E-R-G?
Doris was her middle name.
B-E-R-G.
Lived up in Washington Heights. She worked on the Manhattan Project, and that's where I met her. It was love at first sight. And I guess it was with her, too. Because once we discovered one another, we became virtually inseparable. And it's really hard to describe the wonderful feeling of being in love as we were, as I was. I mean, that was really one of the great experiences in my life. It's a long time away from me now, and I don't think about it ever, but there were times when I had reason to remember how things were, and they were indeed wonderful. I mean, it was just an absolutely marvelous experience to be in love for the first time as I was then. Now, I have had other girlfriends before that, some rather pretty and some very smart, but there was really something different about her, and I don't know quite what it was.
Well, you shared a professional interest with her, too.
Well, we worked at the same place, so we were. It was not hard for us to see one another. She lived in Washington Heights, and I lived very close to the Manhattan Project, so I would have to take the subway to get to see her on weekends, but that was not a big deal. And we very quickly decided to get married, which we did. I was 21 or 22 at the time. I guess I was about 22 at the time. She was just a few months older. We got married. I don't remember the year. Now I have to look it up. And we were still working on a project. We quickly found an apartment on Claremont Avenue, which was a very interesting place to live, because on Claremont Avenue was the back of Riverside Cathedral. It was a very short street right near City Hall. It stretched from about 123rd down to 116th. And apart from...
That wasn't City College.
No, City College was 135th.
It was Columbia.
Well, it was right near Columbia, that's right. Near Columbia. Of course, that's why I could walk to work. But City College was just uptown for another mile or so. At 135th and Convent Avenue. But you're right, it was closest to Columbia. And it had on the other notable building on Claremont Avenue was the Juilliard School of Music, which was located closer to 116th Street. When we first got married, we applied to International House, which was also located on Claremont Avenue. But they already had their quota of non-foreigners, and so we couldn't get an apartment there, but that was our first choice. We did find an apartment on Claremont Avenue in a rather nice building, and it was a lovely street to work, to live on, because the people on the street were quite friendly, and living in the same apartment building was Madame Levine, the widow of Joseph Levine, and they were very famous pianists. They were duo pianists, but they were very, very famous in their day. Joseph had died, and Madame Levine was still living in that apartment. And from time to time, we would hear her play, and we would sit on the steps listening to her playing music. So we had our own private concerts in that building. And it was a nice place.
What was her first name?
I don't remember. I always thought of her as Madame Levine. Joseph Levine and Madame Levine. We were also a very short lot. Claremont Avenue is parallel to Riverside Drive, and it was just walking a very short street to get to Riverside Drive. But Claremont Avenue was closed at both ends, so it's sort of almost a cul-de-sac. Nice private street to live on. And people in the building were also very interesting people. We made some very good friends in our building. After the project folded, we continued to live on Claremont Avenue through all my graduate days. And then we moved, as I said, we moved to Cleveland. We had always wanted a child, but it wasn't until we came to Pittsburgh we were unable to have a child for reasons, one of these mysteries. She only had one ovary, but I don't know if that can really contribute to it. So we adopted a child in Pittsburgh, and our oldest child is an adopted child. He lives in California. In Pittsburgh, I worked for Westinghouse.
What year was that?
I came to Pittsburgh in 1950. And I came during the worst snow, I think, in the history of Pittsburgh. 36 or so inches of snow. It was just a few months after I got to Pittsburgh. I got to Pittsburgh around June of 1950, and the snow, I think, was in November of 1950.
It was over Thanksgiving.
When I applied for the job and was accepted for the job at Westinghouse at the research laboratories, they had some people there who tried to relocate newcomers and find apartments for them. And most of the people who worked at Westinghouse lived in the suburbs. That was the place to live. Have a private house. Churchill Valley was the place, and there were similar places that people lived who worked at the labs. And so they got me an apartment at Claremont Avenue, and they urged me to take it, and I did. And it was there that we lived during the snow. Well, Claremont I'm sorry, did I say Claremont Avenue? I didn't mean Claremont Avenue. They got me an apartment on Laketon Road. Laketon Road, just where it intersects Frankstown. There was an apartment building there, sort of all by itself, overlooking Churchill Valley. And that little area had there was a very small shopping center in that area. It consisted of maybe a half dozen stores and a gas station. When we had that big snow, the city was an absolute standstill, and we were somewhat remote. We weren't living in Squirrel Hill. The snow shovels just never came around, and they couldn't even get to us, let alone wanting to get to us, which I don't think they wanted to either. So we started life by starting eating what we had in the house. Then we started to exchange food with the neighbors in the building, because some of them had little children who couldn't eat some things, and they wanted some other things that the children could eat. Well, pretty soon we ran out of that. And about a week into this snow, still no movement around there, we were seriously considering breaking into this little grocery store that was a block away and leaving money behind. But it was getting desperate. People were really running out of food. I mean, not everybody keeps a week's food in the house. And you can't drink floor polish. But luckily, we really talked about doing that under controlled conditions. I mean, not trying to take advantage of anything, but leaving the money behind and so on. And keeping a record of what we took. But as it happened, it turned out not to be necessary, because the snow clouds did even come through just about the time we were planning to do something. And they managed to clear the streets sufficiently so that traffic could move. And so some semblance of order was restored. Eventually, everything, of course, the filling station opened up and everything went back to normal. But that was my introduction to Pittsburgh. Working for Westinghouse was very nice. Westinghouse was one of the three most important laboratories in the United States in the sciences, in physics and chemistry and so on. The other two were Bell Labs, which was generally considered to be number one, and General Electric, which was considered number two, and Westinghouse was three. We were a major laboratory. There were 2,000 people working in the laboratory, of which about half were professionals, and of those, probably another half, maybe 500, had PhDs. So it was a major, major senior, you know, a laboratory to be reckoned with. And we had a lot of freedom in those days to work on almost anything that we wished, as long as it bore some relationship to Westinghouse's interests. And a great many people worked on important scientific projects. We were not constrained in any way, and the funding was such that there literally were very few strings attached to the work we did.
Where was the lab?
The lab was located, at that time, the lab was in Forest Hills. Eventually, around 1954, maybe 55, thereabouts, they built a new laboratory in Churchill Borough, where it's presently located. And we had the benefit of being able to design our own lab, so I could design, because it was a brand new building, I could design my laboratory, which was really very nice. Anyway, the work was very interesting, and the people were very interesting, and I met a lot of very nice people, and made a lot of good friends there. And it was quite stimulating. We could go to meetings. I mean, it was really like a university in many, many respects. It was like a university without teaching duties. Which brings up another point. I always loved to teach. When I got my PhD, my intention was to go to a university. The problem was that my wife and I had no money. And in those days, universities did not pay well. And particularly, they didn't pay well. They didn't pay their junior staff well. Once you got tenured, you got reasonable pay. But an untenured new professor would not get well paid. I did interview for a number of jobs. In fact, my thesis advisor helped me and encouraged me in several directions. I interviewed, for example, a case at Western Reserve. Case, with a very prominent person in the field, and I think I would have had that job if I wanted it. But we decided, and it was a conscious decision on our part, that I would get a job in industry for 3 or 4 years, save up enough money, and then go to the university. Well, unfortunately, that really never happened. One thing led to another. Once you start earning money, you hate to give it up.
And you earn more.
And you want to earn, that's right, and of course you get raises, and the system, it sort of sucks you in a way. And it would take a rather determined man to want to change, and actually there was no reason to change, because here I was working at a laboratory which was fully the equivalent of university laboratories, in fact in many respects very much better than university laboratories, because we had unlimited funds. And at the university in those days, before government funding became a big thing, university people really didn't have the kind of financial support that people at Westinghouse did. In addition, there were no teaching duties, so that we could devote our efforts to research all the entire day. And it was really, in many respects, better than a university. In And so there was no incentive to change. And so I was really happy there. And as I said, the work was interesting. They let us publish. The more you published, the better they liked it. They would provide money to go to meetings. It was in every way almost the best of all possible jobs. Slowly over the years, that began to change. As the finances changed and the more than just the finances, the culture of industry began to change. A greater emphasis was put on work that had a greater relevance, so to speak. Now, the two things that stimulated this unfettered research were Sputnik and the invention of the transistor, in reverse order, actually. The invention of the transistor gave a tremendous boost to basic research, because it came out of two theorists who were basic research people, John Bardeen and William Shockley. And it showed the great importance of basic research in providing new ideas for the future. But after a number of years, people began to say, in effect, well, we've done the basic research, now it's time to get some devices out of this. And besides which, there was always the notion, what have you done for me lately? And that those two forces started to drive basic research towards more and more applied research. This was a very slow process, and I was fortunately relatively immune from this process for many years. And so I'd say for 10 years at Westinghouse, or maybe 15 years, I was very happy, and I worked quite happily. There was no incentive to leave the laboratory. Eventually, the pressures to do more directed research grew, and I returned to the idea of going to university. And I did interview, and I did have some very good offers, but I must say, in all fairness, I got cold feet. And I thought I was not so terribly driven to change. And at that point, I was already divorced. So I was, I'll get to that. Yeah. When did I get divorced?
No. First, I want to know when you adopted this child.
Oh, we adopted the child in 1954. I think it was 54. Yeah, in 1954.
And what was his name?
David. Did I not say that?
If you did, I'd pick it up.
Okay, his name is David. He now lives in California, Los Angeles.
Does he have a family?
I have a family consisting of David, who is my first child, Peter, who is child of Dorothy and me, and a stepson, whose name is Paul, who lives in Los Angeles, and who's Dorothy's son by her former marriage. Paul was born in 1955, so he's going to be 43. David is 44, and Peter is 27.
Well, while we're talking about them in age, we'll find out. 27,
you
said.
27.
Yeah. So much younger than the other two.
Yes, because he's the product of a second marriage, and there was a big gap between the first.
Peter. Is your son in Dorothy?
That's right.
Peter's an architect now.
Peter's an architect who lives in New York.
Is he married?
No. None of them are married.
Oh, that's unusual.
It is.
So, what are the other two?
Paul is a musician. And David was in an auto accident when he was about 10 or 11. And he's somewhat handicapped. He works for El Pollo Loco, which is a semi-fast food, Mexican-style chicken restaurant in Los Angeles.
Well, okay. Did you finish with?
Well, I was talking about Westinghouse, and I got divorced. Dorothy and I have been married maybe 30 years, and I got divorced.
Oh. How did you meet Dorothy?
Folk dancing. I met Dorothy folk dancing.
Say it again.
Folk dancing.
What was her name then?
Dorothy, her name was Ekman, E-C-K-M-A-N.
Okay, and she was married before and had this
married
job.
And that's right. And when I came, when I got divorced, a girlfriend of mine introduced me to folk dancing. She was not really a folk dancer, but she knew about it. And she had gone occasionally. One day she said, "Well, why don't we go down for foot dancing?" So I said, "Fine." We went down and I liked it. So in time, I kept coming back. And eventually, met Dorothy.
Did she work? What was she doing at the time?
Dorothy comes from Vandegrift. And, when she got divorced, she needed a job after a few years when Paul was old enough. She went back to school and became a librarian. She had gotten a degree at Carnegie Mellon, which was at that time called Carnegie Tech. She was a Carnegie Tech graduate, and she majored in home ec and started life as a teacher, but didn't like to teach, so decided she seek a new career. That new career was to be a librarian. So she went to Carnegie Tech, which at that time had a very good library school. Eventually that library school was transferred over to Pitt. But she got her master's in library science and has been a librarian. So when I met her, she was already a librarian. But she was living in Pittsburgh then. She had moved to Pittsburgh from Vandegrift and brought her son here because the job opportunity were a lot better here, and she got the job at Carnegie Library, where she has worked on ever since. She took a break from her job when Peter was born, but by the time Peter was 3 or 4, she went back to work.
Is she Jewish?
No.
So, in your...
She's not Jewish by birth, but she's more Jewish than I am.
That's usually what happens. Well, when you brought...
Well, it was she who always brought out the Hanukkah candles, for example.
When you were raising Peter, was he raised as a Jew or...
He was raised as a nothing.
A nothing.
And non-religious. When he went to Princeton, however, Peter graduated, went to far. Well, first he went to this children's school at CMU. They have a wonderful nursery school. Absolutely wonderful. And then he went to Falk. And from Falk he went to Kiske. He's never been in a public school in his life.
I remember when he was born. I remember when you had him.
And then from Kiske, he went to Princeton. He graduated from Princeton with a degree in liberal arts with an architecture major. And went to University of Pennsylvania, where he got a master's in architecture. And now he's living in New York as an architect, working for an architecture firm. He needs about another couple of years, a year or two, before he can qualify to take his licensing exams to become a registered architect. Paul, as I said, is Paul. When Dorothy came to Pittsburgh, she put Paul in school here, and he went to what's that grade school on Beachwood Boulevard?
Brandon?
No.
Beachwood?
No.
Not Minute. You're not talking about Minute Day,
right?
Oh, I know. Colfax.
Colfax. He went to Colfax and then to Taylor Auditorium. He got interested in playing music. And when he graduated at Taylor Auditorium, he hooked up with a band that had a big following in the Tri-State area. They played country music. And he was hired with and toured with them, but never liked country music. So he got a job with a band that played nightclub-type music, sort of nightclub jazz. And they did the circuits, and every year they would go to the same places back. Holiday Inn and Holiday this, and Hospitality Inn, wherever they had music in the nightclubs. And they would make the circuit playing 2 weeks in each place. And he decided that that was it. He'd hit the top in Pittsburgh. There was nowhere else to go. So he made a career move to Los Angeles, where the action was.
What does he play? He
plays bass guitar. And that's where he's lived ever since. And he does okay.
Oh.
That is, he supports himself.
Yeah.
He never got married.
Huh.
For what reason, I don't know. I think he doesn't like to be pinned down.
Do you do anything in the community? Do you belong to any organizations?
Too many.
What are some of them?
I'm on the boards of the OCIU. I just recently, local OCIU, I've been on their board for many, many years. And I was one time the state ACLU treasurer. And until this year, I was on the board of the state ACLU, that is ACLU of Pennsylvania. I'm on the board, been on the board off and on, the Pittsburgh Chamber Music Society for many, many years. I'm a past president of that organization. There's a new organization called the Steinway Society, and I did a great deal to organize that organization. I got them their made the Constitution, wrote their Constitution. I got them the incorporation, their tax exempt status, made them a legal organization. But I didn't want to be president because we're away too much, so I'm vice president. That I've been with the 14th Ward Democratic Club since its founding. That's a great organization. I've been with ADA for many, many years. And let's see, what else? Well, I'm trying to get a musical thing started in Spain, which is going very slowly.
Where?
In Spain.
In Spain,
yeah. Let's see, what else?
Why Spain? Why does
we have an apartment in Spain.
Ah.
In a small village, you know, we get some music back down.
What's the name of the village?
Mojaca, That's going very slow.
Okay, tell us a little bit about what life was like in Poland.
We lived with my grandparents, and my mother did all the work in the house. I was confined to the house, so I had really no one to play with. So I was on my own most of the time. I would occasionally nag my mother, but she was always busy, it seems, cooking or cleaning or doing something, mostly cooking. My memories of her are and she was always in front of the stove. Now, the stove was a wood-burning, coal-burning stove. And one of the interesting things about that stove, and it sort of fascinated me at the time, was it had a bunch of rings, nesting rings, and you took out the ring that was just large enough to hold the pot. So you took out all the rings except the one that would just be large enough to hold the pot. So the pot was actually over the fire. And that meant that you had to clean that pot because it got sooty. And they had a kind of a pond-like device for lifting out these rings. And it was a big stove, big black stove, with I'd say maybe a half dozen or so holes for pots and pans.
How did you heat the house?
Well, I don't really know how the house was heated.
You were only 6 years old when you
But I do remember that it was not heated well.
With either hot air or
radiators. It may have had radiators.
Fireplaces, too.
Well, it may have had radiators.
Wood burning stoves.
No, I don't think it had. It didn't have fireplaces, but it may have had radiators. But I can remember winters when the room, when I woke up in the morning, was very, very cold. And the windows were completely frosted over.